I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Oh, well. So sorry, Chicago, but the 2016 Summer Olympics will be in Rio. A stunned Windy City was eliminated along with Tokyo in the first round of voting. We'll have analysis a little later in the program. But first, deflating economic news as well today. The government huffed and puffed on the economic balloon, but today the Labor Department reports that despite boosts from cash for clunkers and rebates for home buyers and talk of the end of the recession, another 268,000 Americans lost their jobs last month, far worse than what economists expected. Nigel Gault is chief U.S. economist for the economic forecasting firm IHS Global Insight. Nigel, we knew there would still be unemployment after signs of economic growth in the last few months, but why this much? What happened?
Well, I think there's two things here. Firstly, in the private sector, firms are being very, very slow to rehire. They're still imposing very, very strict cost controls. Their output is going up, but they're finding that they can produce this extra output just by raising productivity. They're still cutting back on employment. Secondly, in the government sector, we're getting quite severe cutbacks in state and local governments coming through. That was particularly evident this month, start of the school year. We saw cuts in employment, both at the local government level, high schools, at the state government level, colleges, universities. So education was a big influence on this month's numbers.
So the official number has nudged up from last month's 9.7 to 9.8, but that doesn't count the 500,000 more Americans who've given up looking for full-time work. That unemployment number shoots up, we understand, to 17%, and you say it's even worse.
Well, if you look on the payroll numbers, which is a slightly different way of counting the unemployment numbers, the government at the moment says that we've lost a total of 7.2 million jobs since the recession began. But they also told us today that that payroll count is likely to be revised to show a loss of another 800,000 jobs. So the true story right now is that on total employment, we're 8 million below the peak.
Well, and we were doing some math. And it seems as if the loss, the loss of jobs sort of wipes out almost every single job created in the last decade.
Unfortunately, as of right now, we are essentially back where we started in total employment as of January 2000. And unfortunately, where we're heading by the time we get to the end of this year, 10 years on, we're going to be clearly below where we started in 2000.
So what are these green shoots or glimmers of hope that Fed Chair Ben Bernanke's been pointing to, things like increased productivity? What does that mean? Are less workers, fewer workers doing more output?
They are indeed. Yes, we're seeing green shoots in the overall level of activity, some indications housing starts bottoming out, perhaps some improvement in business spending, certainly a big improvement in exports. So that means that the economy is now growing again. It did grow in the third quarter, but as of yet, it hasn't grown fast enough for companies to need to hire more workers.
And yet we're hearing from Washington, remain calm, everyone expected job losses. Just briefly, what's the policy debate here?
Well, our questions on the policy, do we need more fiscal stimulus? Is this recovery just going to fizzle out? Does the government need to step in and do more? Very difficult to think that one through. The government's already done an awful lot. The budget deficit has expanded dramatically. Some things need to be done, probably extending unemployment insurance benefits, perhaps more help for state and local governments. But I'm not sure how much more the government can do. I'm afraid it's going to be a very, very long and slow process of recovery.
Because do we get in a cycle here where consumer spending, which we know is a huge part of the economy, might slow down because people aren't going to buy because they're afraid of losing their jobs, and yet we're being told that they should save. So what should they do?
That's the big conundrum here. In the long run, we want consumers to save more because we'll have a much healthier economy if they do. But in the short run, if they decide to save more and if they don't have income because employment is declining, that's going to put a weight down on consumer spending, which is the biggest share of spending in the economy.
Okay, we'll continue to watch all of this. Nigel Gault, chief U.S. economist for the economic forecasting firm IHS Global Insight, as new unemployment numbers today show a bigger drop than expected. Nigel, thanks so much.
Thank you.
We're going to have all the news for you at the half hour, but today a Friday break from the headlines to note a milestone. 50 years ago tonight, Americans watching CBS heard this. The debut of The Twilight Zone, the brainchild of Rod Serling.
What you're about to see, gentlemen, is a series called The Twilight Zone. We think it's a rather special kind of series. The thing we're concerned with, the thing we're aiming for, the thing we're working toward is entertainment. This is a series for the storyteller.
That's Rod Serling a half century ago making his pitch to advertisers, and what a storyteller he was. Serling wrote 92 of The Twilight Zone's 156 scripts and hosted them all, from the very first show in which a man wanders a deserted town. There's no one to talk to, because in the last second we find out there is no town. He's hallucinating. He's an astronaut confined in isolation to see if he can stand it. He can't. And who can forget William Shatner as the airplane passenger, convinced there's a gremlin on the wing?
There's a man out there. Or a gremlin or whatever. Hurry! Hurry! He's out there!
And who would believe him? He's a recovering mental patient whose previous breakdown had been on an airplane. Nightmare at 20,000 Feet and other Twilight Zone classics were screened 2 years ago at the Rod Serling Conference at Ithaca College in Ithaca, New York, where Serling lived and taught and where, after his untimely death at the age of 50 in 1975, his memorabilia was archived.
These are Rod Serling's personal copies of The Twilight Zones and the other films that he kept.
In attendance, film scholars, family members, fans, and former students like myself. I was privileged to have been in one of Rod Serling's writing seminars at Ithaca, and as they get ready to hold another conference this weekend, we thought we'd look again at his impact.
I've been a Twilight Zone fan since 1959.
What you got here?
I had cards printed up, 6-inch by 4-inch cards. I would tape the episode, pick a good line in there. I sent the card to an actor, I got a list of addresses, and I very nicely asked them if they would handwrite this quotation on one of my cards and send it back to me.
Look at this, and it reminds us of who these actors were. Here's Cloris Leachman.
Oh, there are many of
Yeah, who are like some of the actors?
Burt Reynolds, Leonard Nimoy, Art Carney.
Give me another line, a line that jumps out.
It's a cookbook. Aliens from outer space come, and they have a book to serve man, and everyone thinks it's great, and they all want to go to the planet. But then someone who's translated it finally says, don't go on there to serve man. It's a cookbook.
The rest of the book, to serve man, it's a cookbook.
No! 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 No!
The Simpsons regularly pay homage to Serling. Here's Serling's talking doll.
My name is Talking Tina, and you'll be sorry.
Here's The Simpsons.
I'm Krusty the Clown, and I don't like you.
There's all the time I need and all the time I want.
And then there's Serling's Time Enough at Last, Burgess Meredith playing a book-loving bank clerk after a nuclear holocaust. All that's left are books, but at least he can read until he drops his glasses.
That's not fair. That's not fair at all.
A painful commentary on human folly and nuclear ambitions, and fodder for another Simpsons spoof, a fan gives us the Simpsons take.
Not only did he lose his glasses, but after he lost his glasses, he said, well, my eyesight isn't so bad. And so then after that, his eyes then fall out. After his eyes fall out, he's like, well, that's okay, I can read Braille, and then his hands fall off. Yeah, it is very famous. It's an icon in television.
But why? The shows were clever, but why do the Twilight Zone episodes remain so profoundly popular? When the show debuted in the 50s, Americans feared communists, real and imagined, body-snatching space aliens, soul-sapping corporate America, and the Twilight Zone was a place for them to feel these fears. But for Serling, it became the only place to write about them. He'd railed against McCarthyism and modern-day alienation. His widow, Carol, says that made him radioactive to advertisers.
Very definitely. It was a very serious problem. You know, the sacred cows and advertisers and the network executives made a very difficult time for him.
So what do I do now? I mean, a guy's got to do something.
All right.
a scene from the movie version of Requiem for a Heavyweight. Serling adapted the screenplay from his Emmy-winning live TV drama for CBS's Playhouse 90. Serling was a driving force in this new medium of TV, but the censorship became too much. The breaking point, his planned teleplay about Emmett Till, the 14-year-old black boy who was murdered in 1955. Letters of protest poured into the sponsor, United States Steel Company, and then the script was watered down.
How did he take that? With anger. He was called the angry young man for a long time. After a while, he said, I am not the young man anymore. But no, things he wanted to say. He really felt television had this responsibility to hopefully inform and educate. And when he was trying to tell a story, they emasculated it. The story, the Emmett Till story, which was called at one point, Town Has Turned to Dust. He said by the time they got through with it, the script had turned to dust. They were so emasculated. It wasn't a little black kid who was killed. It was maybe a foreigner. They ruined the scripts. And that made him very upset and very angry, which is why we say at some points that's why he escaped into the Twilight Zone. Yeah. And there he could say what he wanted to, and nobody really bothered him.
Because maybe they didn't get that these were, you know, thinly veiled. I'm thinking of the one, and I'm not like everybody here. I can't remember the exact title, but the one where everyone in the town turns on everybody else.
Monsters Are Due on Maple Street. This is the one story that's in so many of the high school and junior high school textbooks. It's scapegoating and prejudice.
There's two aliens. They're overseeing the whole thing, and in the last couple of seconds you find out that they're behind this and they're showing, look, all we need to do is just do a couple things and they'll turn on each other.
Exactly. That's exactly what the story was about.
And yet that's about Emmett Till.
In a sense.
How does it feel to you to see, even now, people, you know, it's like a Star Trek convention here with the amount of detail they know. What's that like for you to see?
It's very surprising to me, and I think would be most surprising to Rod, to realize that people can recite chapter and verse, entire scripts.
Why do you think that is?
Well, I think the themes, the social, universal themes that he dealt with were important then, and they're still important. They haven't gone away. Bigotry, nuclear war, man's inhumanity to man, all of these things are still right up on top.
There also seemed to be some sort of questioning, you know, are we alone, you know, sort of a spiritual aspect to it. Was there that too?
Well, I think that was one of the themes he dealt with, the fear of the unknown, fear of death, that kind of thing. Could it happen today? I doubt it.
That's Carol Serling, widow of Twilight Zone creator Rod Serling. And by the way, we're listening to one of the many composers that Serling used, Jerry Goldsmith. After the break, we'll hear his influence on writers today, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. In light of today's 50th anniversary of the debut of Rod Serling's Twilight Zone, we've been looking at his legacy through our visit to the 2007 Rod Serling Conference at Ithaca College, where he taught. Twilight Zone only aired for 5 years, but the conference attracted hundreds of his fans, many of whom surrounded Jody Serling, one of Rod and Carol Serling's children. What's it like to see, you know, people still, I mean, so many years later, rapidly deconstructing your dad's work?
I can't even express it. I'm like so ecstatic right now. You know, when he was facing his own mortality, the biggest honor would be just that someone recognized his name and that he was a writer. If he had known what's happening now, it's just amazing what's happening.
When he passed away, he did have a sense of recognition? Like, he must have known at that point how influential he had been and how many people loved his work.
No. I don't think he knew. No. He almost could see beyond. He was before his time. I mean, he was writing about computers taking over and controlling our lives before we even had a computer. But where does that come from? It's almost like he lived another life and he knew it was going to happen.
He was also a great teacher.
I was just talking to somebody about it, that it was like he was the mama duck, and then the baby ducks were the students, and they would just follow him around.
It was a great deal of work for him to do, so we had to restrict the number of students to about 20.
That's Dr. John Kasheshoglu. As dean of the School of Communications in the 70s, he persuaded Serling to come teach at Ithaca. At the conference, he shared rare footage of Serling with students before his sudden death in 1975.
Once you get that pride, that emotional jar, write it down. Don't let it die of boiling in the head.
There was also a screening of the winning entry in the Twilight Zone script project, and attendees were brought up to date on plans to build the Rod Serling Museum in his beloved hometown of Binghamton, New York. Fans were over the moon.
I've been a fan of Rod Serling since I'm 5 years old. The twists in his writing I get goosebumps. One of the recurring messages in all of his work is you can't go home again.
Can't go back to Binghamton.
Right, can't go back to Binghamton. That's exactly right.
Everybody has a hometown, so you can go home again.
And the place isn't what it was when you were younger.
Born-again Christians often say, what would Jesus do in any given situation? And in television, we say, what would Rod do?
Mark Scott Zikrie is an established television director and writer. He's also author of the bestseller, The Twilight Zone Companion.
For Rod, for him, he wasn't trying to write, gee, it'd be fun to put guys in spacesuits. No, he was writing about the real world and using science fiction to hide his message and get it past the censors. Twilight Zone, one thing that was emblematic of it was the twist ending, the surprise. One of his favorite writers was O. Henry, and so Rod loved those kinds of stories.
And you're here now with people who know these episodes inside out, know every line.
Yeah, it's... Well, people, this is our common mythology. I mean, we've all grown up watching these episodes. One day I was 10 years old, and my stepfather and I were down in the garage. He was doing some kind of handyman thing, and I was watching this amazing story of these astronauts who land on a planet and see a duplicate of their crashed ship and their own dead bodies, and they're trying to decide if they're dead or if aliens are trying to fool them somehow. And there's this strange guy in a suit introducing it, suit and tie, with a cigarette, and I thought, what on earth is this? He was really the first of his kind, because prior to Rod, writers who worked in television, it was the producers who ran the show. They were not writers. Writers were subordinate to the producers. And when Rod created Twilight Zone, he was the boss. And he was the first writer to really become a TV star. But he kept his artistic sensibility all the way through his life.
What a tremendous loss, we're reminded. You know, so young, 50 years old, yeah. In 75 he died. What would he be doing today? What would outrage him? Do you think he'd even get on TV with all reality programming?
Well, it's fascinating. I'm sure he'd be writing about what's going on with people being held without trial, people being tortured, he would definitely be taking a stand.
Rod Serling was very clear about what propelled him into writing. It was the war.
Yes. Well, he was a paratrooper in World War II, and jumping out of airplanes into jungles full of men trying to kill him, and he was wounded. He had a shrapnel wound and was hospitalized, and he came out of World War II with this burning need to get something off his chest. He needed to expunge that.
As fierce as he was, as angry as he was, often Carol told us he was the angry young man.
Yes.
He loved what he carried around in his heart, it would seem, this place that was Binghamton, New York, that was America as it should be.
So I think he always had a longing for and an appreciation of the small-town life. Balanced man in that way. He had a good life and a good working life.
And I'll tell you something that not too many people know about Rod during his final days on Earth. When he was in the intensive care unit at the hospital, he asked for his audio recorder, and he began dictating and reflecting on his mortality.
I don't really have a fear of death that I once I thought. What I do have is a terrible awareness of how little time there is to accomplish so many of the things that you want to accomplish.
In a hushed auditorium, we listened to Rod Serling's last recorded words after his first heart attack just before his death. At the request of his family, we're only going to hear a few seconds now, but in them, you hear his character.
What seemed to be the most predominant in my fears was that there was a relationship that was going to be end. It would end. It wouldn't be with Carol. It wouldn't be with kids. It wouldn't be Jody and Nan. There wouldn't be any opportunity to watch their growth, to see the good things happen to them.
And in Rod Serling's voice, you hear his many characters. The evening closed with a screening of Walking Distance, the story of Martin Sloan, the ad executive who goes back in time to try to confront his younger self.
I only wanted to tell you that this is a wonderful time of life for you. Don't let any of it go by without enjoying it. Merry-go-rounds, no more cotton candy, no more band concerts. I only wanted to tell you that this is the wonderful time for you. Now, here. That's all, Martin.
A scene from Rod Serling's Walking Distance. We'll leave you with music from Bernard Herrmann's score and be back after a break here and now. There was stunned silence in Daly Plaza in Chicago today, but Brazilians went wild in Rio as that city was selected the site of the 2016 Summer Olympics, Rio winning over runner-up Madrid, third place Tokyo, and Chicago, which was eliminated in the first round by the International Olympic Committee. What's up with that? It's being called one of the most shocking defeats ever handed down by the IOC. President Obama flew in at the last minute, gave a speech. The First Lady lobbied for 2 days for her hometown, but maybe none of that really factored into things. John Powers covers everything Olympic for the Boston Globe. He joins us now. John, Chicago didn't even medal. your thoughts on that?
Well, I think it's big news when the second city comes up fourth. That is clearly a problem. I think that was even more shocking than Rio getting the games. I mean, after all, no South American country has ever done it.
Sure.
It clearly was time, but everybody thought at least that Chicago would come no worse than second, that they would be a finalist. To only get 18 votes in the first round, that's the earliest a U.S. bidder has gone out since 1976, when L.A. was out behind Montreal and Moscow. It may not have had as much to do with Chicago as the U.S. itself. I know the IOC, there's still lingering resentment of the Salt Lake bidding scandal.
Right.
2002.
The bribery scandal there, yep. Mm-hmm.
The Atlanta Games, there was a bombing. They didn't like the whole commercial aspect to it. And there's been recent issues with the U.S. Olympic Committee about revenue sharing and about the USOC trying to put up their own Olympic network. So I think if you're looking to vote for reasons against Chicago, you could certainly find them.
One can't imagine American broadcasters being receptive to the idea that the IOC wanted to have its own Olympic television network.
That's right.
Yeah, so that was one of the behind-the-scenes squabbles. But any sense, though, I mean, just to have looked at this, when then-Prime Minister Tony Blair campaigned for London, for the Olympics, they ultimately won. He was there forever, made a big effort, spoke French. Obama only there briefly and was caught on tape saying he's just going to fly in and fly out. Do you think that had any impact or no?
Yes, I think he needed to be there because you can't be the only head of state not there, and certainly no U.S. president has gone before and has probably hurt them. But to do basically a drop-in and to not even stay around for the vote, I think that was probably taken as a slap in the face by the IOC members. I think to not have gone would have been a bad message, but it may almost have been as bad to just kind of do a flyby.
Well,
I think, as you said, Tony Blair did schmooze the individual members, and I think some of that definitely would have helped.
Well, on that point, we just have to say President Obama can't win because he had critics who said he went at all. So, you know, part of the time he spent speaking with one of his top general in Afghanistan. But you mentioned the president of Brazil. He showed a world map showing that no Olympics had ever been held in South America. I mean, that had to be a driving point.
Yes, it was. As a matter of fact, one thing about Rio is that message had been consistent from day one. They would always show that blank map, and as you know, South America is a huge continent, and it literally did stand out, out like a sore thumb. There
Right.
are two big issues we've seen recently. One is Beijing had to finally get the games because it could not ignore the nation, the world's largest nation, and South America finally had to get the games. When you give it twice to Australia and not to South America, clearly that had to be rectified at some point, and this was the time.
So, John Powers, what's your final thought? Did Chicago just save themselves a lot of money, or did they lose a lot of future international trade and jobs?
No, I think they didn't lose much at all. One of the big reservations here was that they have a huge budget deficit that they had a rainy day fund to be able to fix. This is a $2 billion undertaking in a very uncertain time. And I think tomorrow morning, after they've wound up from the hangover, most Chicago people are going to say, you know, it may be better that we didn't get it now.
And people who are criticizing the U.S. presentation, we have to remember that Spain's president, 89, and literally on his, made sort of a deathbed appeal saying, I'm near the end of my time, please grant my country this honor. And that didn't work for Madrid, so
no.
Perhaps nothing was going to work. John Powers, we look forward to your writing in the Boston Globe. As always, thank you.
Thank you, Al.
And we'll be back in 30 seconds. So sorry, Chicago, here and now. Remember all those stories recently about the Beatles rock band, that revolutionary new video game from Harmonix, the makers of Rock Band and Guitar Hero, that would change games forever, enable people to literally be the Beatles? Well, this is not one of those stories. This is a story about the classical clarinet behind the games. That's Harmonix co-founder Aran Agosi rehearsing for an upcoming concert with Radius Ensemble, a critically acclaimed and youthful Boston-based group. A native of Israel, Aran grew up in Massachusetts and studied classical clarinet at the New England Conservatory. But he also studied engineering and computer science with electronic music composer Todd Machover at MIT's prestigious Media Lab, and then with fellow student Alex Rigopoulos founded Harmonix. So we wondered, how was a high-tech company created from a classical clarinet? Tell me a little bit about this Schubert piece that you're rehearsing with Radius.
Right, so this is the Schubert Octet in F major. It is an enormous piece. He wrote it directly in response to Beethoven, who wrote a septet, which was also a very big and popular piece. He wanted to sort of outdo Beethoven.
Oh, boy.
So he made it, he added one instrument and, you know, made it about twice as long.
That's it. So there.
So there.
Surprised, by the way, when they find out you, that guy with the clarinet, are the guy, you know, one of the people behind all these video games?
Yeah, it's not something they're expecting.
Yeah.
You know, and then it's kind of quirky, but the answer is that music is music, right? And it doesn't really matter if it's classical music or rock music or jazz or folk or whatever.
Well, some it does, though. To some, they're purists. I mean, I'm wondering the opposite, too. Do you get classical musicians who are asking you, you know, it has worked out well for you, but what are you doing slumming, you know?
Well, but that's the people clearly have their preferences, and they get dogmatic and religious about what music they think is great. You know, I really believe that all music is great, but the feeling you get when you play music or you perform music, whether it's classical music or rock music or whatever, it's still this wonderful feeling.
Well, you've said that what you want to do through the games is to let other people who haven't performed have that feeling of performance. First of all, what's it like to perform, for instance, with Radius? I've seen you do some incredibly avant-garde pieces.
We did a piece together.
We did a piece from Osvaldo Golahov.
Which was amazing.
It was, yeah. Well, your solo was like Jimi Hendrix meets klezmer.
Right.
What's that like, first of all, to perform with the clarinet?
Well, with the game being what it is, you know, now that question is coming into relief. I've never really thought about it much beforehand, and I don't even think most musicians put active thought into, oh, what does it feel like playing? It's just something that you do, and you know it feels great. But there's a bunch of pieces to it. There's the preparation ahead of time, and that's a very collaborative experience. So there's this wonderful feeling of building something. Then there's the performance, right? You're backstage. You're feeling pretty good about it, but you know that it might not be perfect. You're a little nervous. You go on stage, and now the audience is there, and you're transformed into this different world. And if you can do it, and great musicians can, they take that energy and that anxiety, and they turn it into something positive, this energy that helps the piece come alive even more and be more emotional. And you're performing it, and if you get into that zone, you're communicating something, and you're maybe even learning something while you're doing it.
You're on, just yeah. off the bat. Yeah. Do you have this dotted eighth?
It's not dotted.
Well, we understand that you went back to your academic work at MIT to see how what you learned about the clarinet, and you were also working with computers, might translate into games. Now, your master's dissertation at MIT in 95 was deriving musical control features from a real-time timbre analysis of the clarinet.
Did you find that?
I don't even understand the title of your thesis.
I'm not sure if I understand it either. Let me go and read it again. But it's
a real-time timbre analysis of the clarinet. So you got the clarinet in your hand. What were you trying to learn about the clarinet, and how did that translate?
Well, so the way it started was I sort of had two parallel interests. You know, one was music and clarinet, and the other was electrical engineering and computer science. And I was doing both of them at MIT, but I didn't really think about combining them until I went to the Media Lab, where I realized there was a group, and what they did was combine computers and music together. And it was wonderful. So I worked on a bunch of different things. But then, you know, the thesis was about taking the clarinet sound and putting a microphone up to it, and then having that be analyzed by a computer, and then trying to have the computer say something about the sound. Is it sharp? Is it flat? But there's also more subtle things like, what kind of tone do I have? And is the tone pure? Or is the tone a little rough? Or things like that. So that's what the thesis was about.
I want to leap ahead to the Beatles project.
Okay.
Because you had already just had a tremendous success with Guitar Hero, and you knew that you were giving people this opportunity to sort of feel that they were playing an instrument. And now this new project. Now, we understand Yoko Ono, Paul McCartney, George Harrison's widow, Giles Martin, the son of George Martin, the legendary Beatle producer, all had some input in this.
Well, they had a lot of input.
A lot of input. And we understand Yoko Ono had one of the biggest contributions because she said the Beatles' avatars themselves, the figures, needed more soul. Was that it?
Well, she was particularly focused on John and how John looked and how John moved. Does he move and act in the way that she remembered him? And in the beginning, we didn't have that right. You know, we had someone who looked like John, but we had someone who didn't feel and move like John. And she told us what it needed to be like, and, you know, we did what she said.
In Rock Band.
Because that's the one song, right, that has clarinet in it. But it's a good song.
When we come back, we'll go into the inner sanctum of harmonics. What are they working on now? You're listening to Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world, uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Welcome back. For some reason, there is a huge gong in the offices of Harmonix, the company that created the wildly successful Guitar Hero and Beatles Rock Band video games. Co-creator Aran Agosi is taking us on a tour of the sprawling complex above a nondescript chain drugstore in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Inside is exploding with creativity.
And don't you thought I knew the answer? Well, I knew what I couldn't say.
A warren of cubicles is filled with 20-somethings on headphones singing and playing air guitar at their computers, in part using technology that Aran helped develop studying clarinet sounds at MIT. They're taking songs apart to reprogram them for the video games.
Mm-hmm.
Do you mind telling us what you're doing there?
I was working on We Are the Road Crew, which is a upcoming DLC track.
We get songs in on a weekly basis, and they're prepared here. And then every week, new songs come out for Rock Band.
So all our listeners just went, yeah, they're going to do We Are the Road Crew.
All Motorhead listening listeners that you have, yes.
Motorhead NPR listeners will be pretty psyched.
Yeah.
We understand the thing that's next for you guys is a Rock Band Network where you literally open it up, an open source sort of, and let people put
that's
their
right.
own music on it.
Yeah, it's really exciting. We've been working on this for a long time, but we're finally releasing it. And like I said, we're kind of the bottleneck for music right now. We can do about 10 songs a week. You know, this whole department can do about 10 songs a week. But we'd like to do 100 songs a week or 1,000 songs a week. And the way we do that is we let the bands themselves create their music and put their music into Rock Band. And so they can do all the work that's being done here themselves and upload it to our servers, and then people can buy it and play it.
Finally, we enter what the workers call the Star Chamber. What a job. This is the playroom where they have to try out games like Rock Band. It looks like a frat room, only in addition to the old couches, there's a huge widescreen TV, 4 microphones, guitars. Iran sits at the virtual drum kit, and suddenly, we are the Beatles.
8 days a week is not enough to show I care. Love you every day, girl. Always on my mind.
I think Paul's safe.
I can say, girl, love you all the time.
Do you think that you were better able to do this because of your classic background? In other words, do you think if you'd just been the computer half of this, you could have done it to please someone like a Yoko Ono?
No, not at all. I mean, the reason that we can do this and the reason that we've been successful and people have liked our games is because a lot of us are musicians here. And certainly I play clarinet, and so maybe that's a little different from playing guitar. But we have a lot of people here who play in bands, play guitars, drums. We have a lot of singers. We have people who know what it's like to perform. And, of course, we also have fabulous artists who, I mean, you saw what the thing looked like. It's a beautiful work of art.
Well, you play clarinet, and I'm thinking Alex played in the gamelan.
Well, I played in the gamelan, too. We played together.
And the gamelan is an instrument. It's from Bali?
It's a collection of instruments. It's an orchestra of instruments. Each one is kind of looks like a xylophone with about 8 or 10 keys. And you hit it with these little hammers. But the point of the gamelan is that all 25 people are playing together one piece. And so you can maybe think of the gamelan as one big instrument that's being played by 25 people.
I guess the point is that people like Steven Van Zandt wrote a rave in Time magazine. He says this, the Beatles Rock Band is going to pull kids into playing real instruments.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, there have been people who've been saying the exact opposite's going to happen. They'll get used to playing on a pad.
Thing, right.
Yeah, and I'm thinking that the more your story gets out, hey, did you hear the guys behind Beatles Rock Band play that clarinet
mm-hmm.
and a thing called the gamelan orchestra? That's a very good thing.
Oh, I think so. I mean, we're talking about breaking down barriers, right? We're talking about breaking down people's perceptions. And the thing you have to keep in mind is this is a game. The fact that anyone's even comparing it to playing a real instrument is amazing, mm-hmm. right? Because it's a game at the end of the day. But what we're doing with this game is that we're giving people that inkling of what it's like to play. And maybe it might not be a perfect analogy, but if you play this game and you get excited and you have that smile on your face, you might be inclined to pick up an instrument. And yeah, sure, you might not, but you know, it's and maybe that instrument's a rock instrument, and maybe that instrument is the clarinet, or maybe it's the gamelan.
I'm wondering, I know you've been asked the obvious question, which is, would you do a game like this for classical instruments. And you've said, you know, there's not enough of a market. But I'm thinking, why not?
I would love to do that. And the thing that we've shown with Rock Band is that it gets people excited about music, and it gets people to learn this music in a deeper way, right? It puts people inside the music. And classical music is amazing. There are so many wonderful pieces, you know, that take you on these emotional roller coaster rides. You know, everything from very subtle things to, you know, to very deep things, and the way all the parts intertwined are magical. Yeah. But most people just, you know, flip on the radio and they use it as relaxation music. You know, there's so much more to classical music than people think, and if we could get an experience like Rock Band to happen for classical music or chamber music, it would be fabulous.
Yo-Yo Ma, the band.
Right, the Yo-Yo Ma band, or you know, string. I mean, like a string quartet, right?
Well, I'm staying with clarinet, and I'm thinking, if I could play. Didn't Aaron Copland write the piece for Benny Goodman? Sweet for Benny Goodman. It's the clarinet solo.
Well, there's the clarinet concerto, yeah, that Copland wrote, which is absolutely fabulous. Benny Goodman, even though he's known for jazz, he played classical music.
I think we have something here. It could be a Trojan horse, you know, to get kids.
That's right. That's right. Play. If we kind of, if we're able to figure out how to sneak classical music into Rock Band, then that's the Trojan horse. Yeah.
Aran Agosi. He's co-founder and chief technical officer of Harmonix, makers of Rock Band and Rock Band The Beatles. He's also clarinetist with the Radius Ensemble. For more, you can go to our website, hereandnow.org.